have the privilege to introduce Craig Wong, and I won't lie, I'm going to actually read his bio, but this is indeed a pleasure. Craig Wong is the executive director of Grace Urban Ministries, a congregation-based nonprofit that serves children, youth, and families in San Francisco. A graduate of UC Berkeley, he did campus ministry with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship for several years. He also serves on the advisory board of Christian Community Development Association and writes a column for the Evangelicals for Social Action's Prism magazine. Craig Wong.
You don't have to clap. I wanted to start off by putting a picture of my family on there. My wife, Tina, on the upper left corner, and on her lap is my son, Jacob. And then below him, Kiana, and then Jeremy with the hat, and then little Kirby, who I told folks that actually runs the family. I thought it'd be fun just to share with you my family. I miss them. I love them dearly. And when I take off on trips like this, they will often just say, "You're going to another meeting," you know, and I'm sure some of you are familiar with that. And I have to explain to them that, you know, this is an important meeting, important things are going to happen. But I say that with a little bit of fear and trepidation, especially when I go to, and this, is, by the way, is my fourth SILT, and it's just a huge privilege for me to be at the Spring Institute. But every time I go with a little bit of fear and trepidation, and the reason why I say that is that on one hand, it's kind of funny to think about lived theology, right? Because there's a way in which, in some ways, that could seem like a no-brainer or a redundancy. But it's actually helpful to talk about lived theology in this way, in that it's extremely easy for truth to be talked about, to be argued about, to be wrestled with, to be critiqued, but never embodied. For that reason, you know, I deeply admire Charles Marsh's passion to wrestle with that, to see theology and life come together, because I see such a lack of that. I mean, I think there is something above a theological crisis, I think, in the church today. And if I could sort of continue in a similar vein, it's great to be out there and to stand with a group like that, and to listen to folks speak out against SB 1070. And that is a certain way in which God's people, you know, embody and stand there. But it's also pretty easy, and I've been to a lot of these things. Probably many of you have, too. I've been to a lot of these things, and it's not that hard to take a few minutes to stand out there. And so the thing that I want to do today is that I do want to talk about embodiment. I sort of rephrased. I'm not sure whether this was coined by Charles or Sarah, you know, I sort of condensed it a bit, but I want to try to answer the question that I've been asked to do, and that is, in this case, I want to focus on ecclesiology, but how have ecclesiological convictions shaped our congregational engagement with migration, border, and our immigrant neighbors in San Francisco? And if I can go back to my title here, when I talk about embodying gospel citizenship, that's just a fancy way of saying, what does it mean to be the church? And one reason why I wanted to mention about, you know, a press conference like this is that, you know, I stood with our mayor on more than one occasion, Gavin Newsom in San Francisco, where he just boldly proclaimed San Francisco as a sanctuary city. And he before everybody, he said, you know, the rest of the nation doesn't get it. We do. We are going to make sure that all of our citizens and residents and undocumented residents receive access to health care. We are going to make sure that that our law enforcement does not cooperate directly with ICE. We are not going to volunteer transfers of people that we catch. We are not going to identify whether a person is documented or not. And then we're going to have a municipal ID. We're going to have everybody issued an ID card that will enable them to access all the city services, library services, health services, social services of all kinds, regardless of whether you are documented or not. We're not going to check that. As a Christian, we can really stand by him and affirm that and celebrate the fact that San Francisco can be a sanctuary city and has been actually since the 1980s, with the civil wars in El Salvador, and you had the sanctuary movement of that decade, and San Francisco became a sanctuary city shortly after that, around that time. And then our current mayor, Gavin Newsom, really reinforced that. So now we find ourselves in San Francisco with a mayor who refuses to talk about sanctuary. And because of a brutal killing of a Honduran, of a family by a Honduran youth, actually just a few blocks from where I live, the sanctuary ordinance has really become a shallow shell of what it used to be. And so now we have youth that are being arrested and handed directly to ICE without due process. We have cars being checked. There's checkpoints for cars and cars being impounded among immigrants in our community. And ICE pretty much has its way. And so, especially in the last 4 years, we've had multiple ICE raids in our city. And so, as much as we can celebrate the liberal, progressive city of San Francisco and its sanctuary status, it really doesn't mean a whole lot. And it's these kinds of realities that further fuel my passion for the church. And I was just chatting with someone in the bus earlier, just recognizing how much that as a sinful humanity, we will always get in our own way. And so we have what's called the church. And even though it can be hard to work with church folk are God's folk. And we need to be passionate about the life, integrity, and prophetic witness of God's people. And we must labor and not wane from that commitment. So let me share with you a little bit about a little bit of background. I know that when we come to these settings, and I know very few of you, it's been really fun to get to know some of you, but I know that one of the things that we do is that we're always, we put each other on our ecclesial radar. We're trying to figure out where we are located on the spectrum. So my background is the church that I'm with, which is called Grace Fellowship Community Church. We're Protestant Evangelical. We are Cumberland Presbyterian, which was an offshoot of the PCUSA, or what was what is now the PCUSA, back during the Civil War in America. And we were a mission church that was planted about 150 years ago in Chinatown in San Francisco. And Grace Fellowship was an offshoot of this Chinatown church. But as a result of that Chinatown heritage, we are a largely Pan-Asian, so primarily Chinese, but Korean, Japanese, and Filipino as well, and Anglo. So those are the two primary groups. But then we have an increasing number of Latino and African American in the congregation. So we are sort of Pan-Asian, multi-ethnic, multiracial. About 200 members. And we are, at the core of our congregation, we're primarily a college-educated professional class. I'm going to tell more about that in a bit. But we are this Asian and Anglo college-educated Presbyterian congregation smack in San Francisco's Latino neighborhood. our roots are fundamentalist evangelical. We would go to the Billy Graham Crusades. We would learn the four spiritual laws. We were adherents of dispensationalism from Dallas Theological Seminary. I know that's changed now, but those are our roots. We were shaped by these things. I grew up with these things. But we were led by a pastor by the name of Bob Appleby. He passed away a few years ago with a brain tumor. But he was a man who, as a youth, and he became a Christian in the heart of the civil rights movement in a place called East Palo Alto in California. And so post-World War II, there was a radical demographic shift there. And he was privy to the white church and its response to African Americans moving into the community. And then, of course, you had the riots, the assassination of Martin Luther King. And as a young Christian who had been told by his youth leader to read his Bible, did that. And he began to see that there was a discrepancy between what he saw the church to be in the scriptures, or what it was called to be, and what he was seeing in the white evangelical church. And this is what fueled, which began and sparked for him an ecclesiological journey. I've been sharing with a number of you in conversations that there is a way in which I have really begun to take for granted the fact that theology, the theological task, needs to be at the heart and center of the pastoral, the pulpit, ministry, the life of a congregation. But I think that as I have interacted with the broader ecclesial spectrum in the United States, I begin to see that I can't take that for granted, that I'm grateful for pastors who have made theology and biblical study and sound preaching of highest priority in the formation of the church. And so when I think about my journey and our journey in the immigration realm in terms of advocating for the immigration reform, caring for the immigrant community, I tie that with a great deal and with recognizing God's grace and God's mercy to this ecclesiology that we have wrestled with as a church. In other words, there is a direct link, I believe, in our engagement and what we've how we've been taught. And so we began our journey when we left the Chinatown Church in 1983. We really were driven by two questions. One was, what does it mean to be the church? Which, of course, is the ecclesiological question, all right? But the second question is, what does it mean to be the church in San Francisco? Which is the contextual, or the missiological question. So these are the two twin questions that drove our inception as a congregation and continue to shape us today. I mean, it's a question that we feel like is a lifelong adventure. And there's lots I can talk about this, but there's so many ways to talk about the church, I thought, because this is something that we've been working on as a congregation in the last couple of years, particularly, we've been focusing quite a bit on the Eucharist, and so. I think what I've chosen to do today is to use the language of the Eucharist and the images of the Eucharist to talk about our ecclesiology. And I thought it was very fitting, you know, because after all, Danny Carroll yesterday said that, you know, it's all about food. And so I thought that this would make just a lot of sense. And so the Eucharist is around the Eucharist where we remember who we are and whose we are. We remember that we are sinners. I was just thinking about as we think about the racism and the bigotry of the immigration crisis that we see today. The Eucharist is the absolute and utter equalizer. In other words, it is what levels the playing field. And suddenly, at the table, we cannot light a candle to anyone. Here in this, to each other in this room, to the migrant farm worker, to the to anyone that we see around us, and so at the Eucharist we remember who we are, and we then remember that we are people who fundamentally are in need of confession, that we are in need of this Redeemer who forgives us of our sins. And this is something that we have been learning to practice more and more as a congregation. And one of the things that we have done in the last few years, particularly, has been to have occasional corporate confession. And so we basically, in our sanctuary, put up two microphones, have two long lines, you know, 75 people each, and we took turns going up in front of the congregation and then confessing the ways in which we have sinned against the congregation. A couple years ago, when we first did this, you know, there was lots of ways that people expressed their confession, but it was really interesting to see that there was really two camps. One group confessing the ways in which they have been judgmental towards each other in the congregation, and then the other side confessing how they have hidden in fear of judgment. And there was just so much baggage that had built up, you know, as a congregation, and we had to learn to forgive one another. It was really a jubilee of relationship. Let's actually believe that Christ can help us start over in a relationship with one another. Another way to think about the Eucharist and the table is that it really is about reorienting us to what is true. You know, oftentimes it's tempting to think about worship as that place where you go to get a little respite from the harsh realities of the world. But we like to think of worship as being the opposite of that, and that is that it's actually, we leave a world where we've been lied to all week long, and we come to the table, and we are reoriented to what is actually true. We get to rehearse reality at the table. So communion, embodying God's fundamental design. You know, we had a chance as a pastoral staff. By the way, I'm not a reverend. I love reverends, but I'm not one. Okay. You know, I'm my tombstone is going to say, quote unquote, Reverend Craig Wong, I think it's going to say on there. But we had a chance a few weeks ago to go and listen to Desmond Tutu in San Francisco, which was really a treat. But I love the way he talks about Ubuntu theology. But really, what he's saying is simply, he's basically saying from an African cultural perspective that God just fundamentally designed us to be interconnected with one another. And so the table is where we affirm that we were just called and made to be connected to one another, as Desmond Tutu says, I am because you are. Communion helps us to understand that. We talked about this yesterday. I think Danny talked about this. Loaves and fishes, another image of the table. And we simply, as the church, can give as if there's enough for all, because there is. That's just the reality. And so, as we rehearsed yesterday, that's a reality that that the world does not know. The church, we are called. We have this deep privilege to actually live that way. And at the table, all are invited. And so, another thing that characterizes being the church or our gospel citizenship is that we live as a welcoming community. All are invited to the table. And lastly, the great banquet, we see the kingdom of God described in Scripture over and over again as a banquet, as a great dinner. And it is a picture of what is to come. In other words, the great banquet, this image of all peoples gathering together around the table in fellowship with one another, is a picture of God's good future. And one way that we've liked to talk about this is that the church is an eschatological community. And I put down here that that as an eschatological community, our roots are in the future, but our branches are in the present. I'm quoting folks, and I can't remember who wrote them. You might know. I wanted to just summarize summarize what I've just said about the church, and that when we live out what is true as a church, then the church is inherently profoundly political and prophetic. I just took out a piece out of our position paper as a congregation, but it says, "We trust the giver of grace, forsaking every pretender to his throne, every god of this age, living our lives faithfully only to him." And that's the political statement. In other words, faithfulness is about allegiance. Citizenship is about allegiance. It is really proclaiming who are we ultimately accountable to, who will we ultimately trust, who will we ultimately obey. So therefore, being a Christian, following Christ, is a profoundly political act. The church the church exists as an alternative polis. In other words, we engage civically in the halls of power in Washington, and we try to influence legislation and all that. We know that even the best democracy is broken. And so the church has an opportunity to live out an alternative polis. Another way that we'd like to talk about the church is that it is the only organization that exists for the sake of its non-members. Again, I'm stealing someone's quote. That is a way that we have understood our ecclesiology has led us to an understanding that, you know, we exist for the sake of a world that is desperately lost. So we live as, and I think it was Rene Padilla that said this, we live as an embodied question mark. In other words, the church needs to be peculiar. That's a real challenge for, I know that's a challenge for us in San Francisco, where, justice is a very strong category for the church in San Francisco, you know? I mean, I'm just kidding. Justice is a very strong category for pagans in San Francisco. It is a city that probably has more nonprofit organizations doing all kinds of incredible work in the city, serving the poor, the vulnerable, the immigrant community. So what makes the church any different? This is a question that I think that the church needs to ask. There needs to be a way in which the church operates that actually raises questions for our both conservative and liberal friends in the city that we live. And so this gets fleshed out. One way to talk about this is that the church really finds itself in a conflict of competing narratives. And so what I'm going to do here is just sort of recap those Eucharist metaphors that I just walked through. Whereas the gospel narrative is that we are sinful but redeemed, the dominant culture says that we're exceptional. We talked about this yesterday. The gospel calls us, is a narrative that is communal and interdependent. And the dominant culture says that we are to live autonomously and self-sufficient. The gospel says that we are provided for. And the dominant culture says that we are entitled. Somehow that we have, what we have is because we've somehow earned it or don't deserve it. The gospel is transnational, transcends all human borders. The dominant culture is nationalistic, and there's also other ways to break that down, obviously, by race, by gender, any tribe of any kind within our culture and our society. And the gospel is hopeful, and the dominant culture is optimistic or cynical. We hope for change. So I wanted to, so that's sort of the backdrop. I want to just talk a bit about the Asian immigrant story in an extremely brief sort of way, and talk about how that relates to what I just said about the competing narratives. This quote comes off of a Chinese inscription on Angel Island. You guys familiar with that? And it's sort of the Ellis Island of the West. My grandmother contemplated committing suicide there on that island because she had been was detained there for such a long period of time. She was basically so close to the United States, but yet so far. I mean, it's only a 25-minute ferry ride away from San Francisco. But she was in crowded quarters with a bunch of other women in a very tight facility and sick. And so this quote was one of thousands of things that were written on the walls in Angel Island, which I think are very helpful. They definitely are these commentaries on what the Chinese were feeling at the day. So I thoroughly hate the barbarians because they do not respect justice. They continually promulgate harsh laws to show off their prowess. They oppress our people and violate treaties. They examine book for bookworms and practice hundreds of despotic acts. This was 1920. This is the Chinese talking about the white majority regime in the United States. And then, so that's one side of the story. The other side of the story is the model minority, which is the Asian success narrative. And in the 1970s, I can't remember when, but there was a Time Life article which was really, actually, I'm not sure if it was time or life, maybe it was both. But Asians topped the Anglo income. I mean, it was this significant revelation that that Asians had actually had passed whites in terms of median income. And so this sort of dual characterization of the Asian community is reflected in Prop 187 in the 1980s. Prop 187 really is the equivalent of Prop 200 in Arizona. And so Prop 87 was about withholding all social services from immigrants in California. And there were a lot of other things, just very similar to what it wasn't as draconian as what we have just experienced with SB 1070, but it was a hideous proposition. And it was interesting to find out that Asians in California basically completely split 50-50 on this issue. So half of Asians said, yes, you know, shouldn't be any services for immigrants. And the other half said, we need to provide care for the immigrants. And that captures it right there. And by the way, I'm part of what's called the Christian Community Development Association that was started by John Perkins, who was actually last year's SILT speaker. Last year's SILT was about John Perkins and his legacy. But one of the things that happens for me in the CCDA, which really is a movement that began with the white and black tensions in the South, and that has been the predominant story of CCDA and has shaped CCDA over the years. And when I joined the CCDA about 13 years ago, they really didn't know what to do with me and didn't know what to do with Asians. Because, you know, I'm an ethnic minority, but doing pretty well, you know. And the predominant stereotype of Asians was and continues to be that we are the model minority. That we have learned to play the game. And this is true for many. It's true for me. And it's true for most of the Asians in my congregation. Most of the Asians in my congregation are not struggling immigrants. They're not impoverished Laotian, Cambodian, Vietnamese refugees. They are not persecuted Middle Eastern immigrants or struggling immigrants from India. They are like me, who have had parents here for several generations. My father was one of the first licensed interior designers to graduate from the very reputable art school in Pasadena. My grandfather, my mom's side, was like one of the first photographers in Chinatown and in the Bay Area. My uncle was one of the first licensed radiologists in Stockton. So there's lots of success in my history. I grew up, you know, pretty much as many of my Asian friends grew up with the expectation to become an optometrist or a lawyer or a dentist or a doctor. My father used to always say, you know, well, obviously you're going to be a professional, right? I mean, you know, what else would you be? You know, it was just a given that I would be a professional of some sort, you know. He wanted me to be a civil engineer. That was his thing. And also, it's funny because yesterday Danny was saying that it's all about what you eat. You know, I want to say it's also about who you date. And for my parents, you know, it was understood that you're going to marry within the race, or at least marry a white person. You know, you certainly don't want to marry an African American. You don't want to marry a Latino. And this was just sort of an assumption for us growing up. And so we are shaped by a narrative, you know, without even choosing it. And so this is what, you know, and so to succeed, to link ourselves with those who are perceived as the ones who can succeed, and to be able to continue to build, have a forward trajectory from a difficult immigrant past was really what it was all about. And we Asians love food. And my in-laws provide us with food every time we go to Sacramento to visit them. They're not going to provide food for the local food bank necessarily, but they're going to provide for us. They're going to provide for their family. They're going to provide for their own. And so, as you can see, one, as an Asian American, we have been heavily inculcated with a power reflex. You know, we are heavily, I've been enculturated to look for my opportunities and pursue them, to be financially secure. Or one way we like to talk about it is we like to be financially invincible. And financial security is of prime importance. And it didn't really matter really what you did, as long as you were able to have your investment portfolio healthy and you knew where your retirement was going to come from. And so as you can see, that as we wrestled as a congregation with what it means to be the church in the midst of the dominant culture, it's a huge, huge struggle. And so the opportunities to repent and to live in a different way, it was and continues to be a huge, huge challenge for us. But it's also why we desperately need grace, because we're just going to continue to disappoint each other. We are going to hurt our community. We are going to hurt the immigrant community. So I want to try to just share a bit about some of the ways in which this gets fleshed out. I want to definitely leave some time for some engagement with you. But one of the ways that we saw our power reflex come out was through our ministry, which we call Kaleo. Kaleo is a Friday night ministry. You know, we're Presbyterian, so we have programs, you know. Kaleo was one of them. For those of you who know Greek, Kaleo is the word to invite or to call. In Kaleo, we basically began as really more of an educational program. We were this Asian congregation in this Latino community, but we wanted to do good things, and so we listened to the community, found out, you know, what were the needs. You know, we knew that computer literacy, English as a second language, where employment help was some of the needs that were there. And so we formed this ministry. It actually used to be called something else before Kaleo. We're using our resources, we put together a computer lab, we developed curriculum, and we opened up our doors and we said, hey, we are going to serve our immigrant neighbors here, and we're going to be good Christian church people. We had a dinner, but you had to be there between 5:30 and 6 in order to eat it. Folks would come and we'd have this curriculum all set up, but they'd miss a couple of sessions, and so we'd get frustrated. Before you know it, I mean, we began to just see folks come and go. Little did we know that we were just completely offending and pushing away the very people that we were trying to care for. In our earnest to do something and to help and to serve in Christ's name, we are actually undermining the very shalom that we are trying to produce and to be about. So it was a clear place where we had to repent from our power reflex, to repent from this instinct to make things happen, even if they're good things. And we really needed the Eucharist. We really needed the table for forgiveness, for healing, for reconciliation. And what was really interesting was that we decided that we needed some major changes in the way that we approach this thing. And we still have this program to this day, this evening, where we're open to our neighbors and parents. We have a tutoring program, and so the parents of the kids in the tutoring program come to this program. But we have completely changed the orientation of the thing, and it is now a place of hospitality. And folks still receive help in computer literacy and job assistance, or working with unscrupulous landlords, whatever it might be. We have lawyers there that can provide legal assistance, but we fundamentally want this place to be a place where we get to know each other, where we get to hear from each other and learn from each other. I mean, I so appreciated John's stories yesterday about joining and being joined with those who are very different from us, and how much that converts us. And that's what we've been learning in this ministry of Kaleo. And ever since, we became a ministry of nothing. In other words, we're not here to do anything. We're just going to be. Our congregation has been changing and transforming, and we have been blessed with many immigrant families that are changing our lives. Our lives are changed. We are converted when we are living out of our calling to be the church. And it also changes the way that we do public advocacy. And so we've been in multiple conversations with the Board of Supervisors, with the mayor's office, with Nancy Pelosi's office, with Dianne Feinstein's office. But one of the things that we're discovering is that they find the way that we interact with them very peculiar. That as the church, and we sit down at the table with those in power, that they begin to realize we actually want a conversation, that we actually want to hear the struggles and the political challenges that they face, that we actually want to work on constructive options and possibilities together. And I think one of the things that I'm beginning to appreciate more and more is just how rare that is. that they're used to being railed on. They're used to being having fists waving. And to give our leaders and those in power the dignity to be heard, to be valued, to be appreciated, even though we may think completely differently about a particular policy, that there's something very supernatural that is going on in that place. So I wanted to share these stories. I have about 15 minutes or so?
About, if
we
want to have questions, it's only 7 minutes.
Okay. All righty. Sarah had said that I could go over a little bit just because there's a bit of a break, but I...
Okay.
I actually have one more picture I just wanted to show you just as a closing here. This, if you're wondering if evangelicals care about the immigration issue, this was in Arizona a few couple months ago, and these are all evangelical pastors. There's John Perkins there to the left. Danny Carroll was part of this gathering that we had there. But anyway, I just wanted to share that with you. Just if there's any encouragement at all to you that evangelicals have gathered in Arizona, and we'll probably need to do that again.
I just want to ask, how often you all celebrate communion and what elements do you
use? Yeah, that's really an interesting question. I mean, the communion has grown on us. And so when we first were formed as a church, I think we did it, we might have started even once a quarter, you know? And then we went to once a month. And now we're doing it every week because we're just seeing how fundamental the Eucharist is to our identity. And so we do it, and we have a big loaf of bread, and we have Welch's or something, I don't know. But anyway, we'll have the elements, and we'll have two lines. And that's what we do. Yes?
You mentioned that support for immigration is 50-50 in the
Asian
community.
Yeah.
Are there any patterns within that in terms of age or country of origin or generation? And you said yourself second generation, first generation?
I'm third generation.
And how do you count?
Third or fourth generation.
And how do you count generations?
I count it by when you arrive, that's the first.
So your grandparents arrived.
It's complicated. I mean, Chinese immigration is extremely complicated. Sometimes, someone will come and then, make some money, they'll go back, and then they'll send, their family or their, it's complicated. My dad's father was born in Hawaii. But in terms of your question, I don't know the breakdown of those things.
Do you have an anecdotal sense?
Well, I mean, all I would say is that, I mean, the general pattern is that if you, and this is kind of a no-brainer, but if you're, the further generations, if you're well established, if you have things working for you, you're not going to care as much about it.
I thought you were going to say the opposite, actually. That people who are third and fourth generation have kind of forgotten the immigrant experience and have become, quote unquote, Americanized and resist immigration.
I'm sorry, that's what I mean.
Oh, okay.
That's what I mean.
Okay.
Yes. Yes.
You said you don't care as much. I thought you meant whether. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it's a good question, and I don't know whether those, I mean, that was back in Prop 187, it was a 50-50 split. I don't know if it's true today, but they're being great right now. Cool.
And, when you think of Korean immigration, and I'm assuming Korean immigration is probably among the most active
in the
United States.
Was
among the Asian population.
Active in what way?
No, in terms of the numbers of persons still arriving, the volume of persons arriving.
Yeah, I would think. I don't think so.
Philippines?
There's a lot of Filipino immigration. That's huge. Yes,
just coming waves, right? So, I mean, there have been decided waves of Korean immigration in the 60s and 70s, Vietnamese in the 70s and 80s. You see those patterns, Filipino, at least in San Diego, there's a really quite stunning bubbles of ethnic, related often to U.S. foreign policy, of course, and dislocation caused by either U.S. foreign policy or international economics.
Yeah, that's right.
Can I ask maybe one more question?
I was wondering, Greg, if you could say more about how Eucharistic theology breaks down ethnocentrism. Being more explicit about how that Eucharistic theology can really transform ethnocentrism.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, we read as a congregation, we read Gusto Gonzalez's book, Santa Biblia, and one of the images that was so important for us was the metaphor of border versus frontier, and this picture of border that is two-way versus frontier, which is one-way. And so that's one way to talk about how, as I was saying earlier, that the way that the Eucharist is this complete level, right? And it is communion that is this picture of life that we were fundamentally created to be, which is to be completely interdependent with one another. And so that is definitely a counter to ethnocentrism, right? I mean, in other words, we are going to need, not just appreciate, not just celebrate diversity, but actually need it. Actually say that I become more human the more that I embrace and understand and welcome and allow myself, my life, to be shaped by my Latino neighbors, my African-American neighbors, my African immigrant neighbors, and so on and so forth. That's been so helpful for us. I mean, our congregation, we have a dear sister congregation in El Paso, Texas, right across the border from Juarez. You know. Many of their members were former coyotes, very upstanding, respectable coyotes. But to hear their stories, to understand, you know, life on the border, has been just so helpful to us. And the way that we, you know, that their life is an indictment on ours, and our power reflex that we talked about. We have a close relationship with a ministry from some friends in Jos in Nigeria. And so we're able to be in solidarity with them during this very tumultuous time in Nigeria. And all the violence that's going on. And so, but that's been a new thing for us, to just not just give to missions, not just, you know, appreciate the need, you know, or appreciate diversity, but to actually actively want it. You know, we would not have the kind of relationship we do with our mission district in San Francisco if it wasn't for this Latino Spanish speaking Presbyterian church in our neighborhood that was gracious enough to allow us to become their friend and for them to become friends to us and for us to have some joint worship together. And so, you know, it is the Eucharist that drives us to that. Just recognizing our fundamental need for one another. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I guess what would you say to someone who said that, you know, Sunday morning is the most segregated time in U.S. society, that so many congregations still remain ethnocentric, in that they're sharing, their table fellowship is still shared, you know, within a community that's not always diverse. It seems like you have strategies for trying to help congregations break out of that, and you know, maybe it's the unique context of San Francisco that where you've already described some of the diversity even within your neighborhood and the history of the congregation, but I guess that's want us to maybe.
I want to go back to what I started off with. It's interesting because we do have a pan-Asian, multi-ethnic, multi-racial congregation. I don't talk about it that way, but we have become a very diverse congregation, and there's a lot of folks out there that have sort of looked to us for help with that. Like, how do you become that? You know, and we really didn't have a strategy. You know, I mean, it's like, you know, our strategy was, let's try to figure out what the gospel is. You know, what does the gospel say? You know, and we've become this. I'm not trying to be pragmatic. I'm not trying to give a formula. But the gospel. I mean, I'd like to borrow the language that was used last night in the wonderful presentation we heard last night. That the gospel is is overflowing with the resource for religious imagination. I mean, and I think it sort of goes back to what I was saying about this disconnect between theology and living and breathing congregations.
somehow there's some disconnect going on there. You guys could just work together on what that what needs to happen. But I really believe that the gospel makes these walls go down. We will become that as we live out of that. It may be slow, it may be long, it may be painful, but I do believe that's what's going to happen. You know, when the church has just capitulated to what is and what, you know, what's most expedient, what is going to, you know, keep the numbers up or to keep the money flowing in or whatever it is that somehow has co-opted the church's mission, then we're going to have segregated congregations. That's just the way it's going to be. So it's a lack of religious imagination.